we get good at what we practice. Research now tells us very clearly what distinguishes amateurs from experts. It's the amount of time they spend practicing their craft. To become exceptional, you must do two things. First, you must practice with intention. You have to aim to become very good. If you set out just to know how to do something, or do it good enough, then that is how good you will become. To become expert, you have to envision yourself as a master of your craft. Second, you must practice a lot and consistently. Studies show that amateurs practice about 3 times a week for about 1 hour per setting. Those who develop into experts put in 3 hours a day, almost 7 days a week. They become consumed with their craft. In addition, there's a magic number. Becoming an expert demands about 10,000 hours of practice. That's 20 hours a week, every week, for about 10 years. The notion of intentional practice also applies to how we become the beloved community. It's not enough to just say that we are post-racial. We have to practice being post-racial. It is said that if you're not on the court, you're not in the game. We have to put in the time, both on and off the court.
Joy, unspeakable, is not silent. It moans, hums, and bends to the rhythm of a dancing universe. For our free African ancestors, joy unspeakable is drum talk. For enslaved Africans during the Middle Passage, joy unspeakable is a surprise of living one more day. For Africans in bondage in the Americas, joy unspeakable is the moment of mystical encounter when God tiptoes into the hush arbor. Joy unspeakable is humming how I got over after swimming safely to the other shore of a swollen Ohio River when you know you can't swim.
When theologian Barbara Holmes talks about joy unspeakable, she is talking specifically about how the contemplative practices of the Black Church have sustained Black people in America through suffering and survival. More than referring to a particular church or denomination, this experience is collective and transhistorical. It is also a different expression of Black religion than I am expected to exhibit as a Black woman. On more than one occasion, I have had a particular mode of Black worship projected onto me, the more charismatic modes of Black worship that we are so familiar with, the shout, the stomp, the song. That particular style of Black worship sometimes strikes me as a caricature of joy, a shallow stereotype. I see this in the expectation that more Black worship will bring more lively singing, more rhythmic stomping, more energetic worship. I see this in the anxiety that more Black worship will bring more lively singing, more rhythmic clapping, more energetic worship. The shout, the stomp, the song. But this caricature, this stereotype, is a narrow sliver of the complexity and the richness of Black spirituality and Black worship. The modes of Black spirituality that are most powerful, nourishing, and nurturing for me aren't the stomp, the shout, or the song. Instead, I think of the rock, the sway, the bend, the moan, and the hum. And I think of these things done in community. I marvel that in the midst of sadness and sorrow, in the midst of feeling the effects of generations of trauma wrought by racism and white supremacy, we can still find joy with each other. We are finding joy in each other. I call it black joy because I am black, and it is the joy that I have been familiar with my whole life. It is the joy that I have learned from black people. It is the joy created through our collective healing, our laying down of burdens to be picked up and shared by our people, our community. This is not joy in spite of suffering, a mask put on to hide pain, an armor put on to push through pain. This is an embrace, holding and soothing us in our suffering. This black joy is joy created through our being together. This black joy reminds me that I am not alone, that trouble don't last always, that I am held and carried forward by a power beyond what I can comprehend. I call it black joy, but I want to offer it to the extent that it is mine to offer, to this faith. One of my gifts to Unitarian Universalism is the suggestion that joy is ours. We are the people who commit to justice, equity, and compassion. We are the people who aspire to world community with peace, liberty, and justice for all. We are the people who affirm our interdependence with each other and the universe itself. I want to challenge Unitarian Universalism and Unitarian Universalists to claim joy. Unitarian Universalist joy will require a different way of imagining ourselves and a different way of being with each other. Claiming the possibility of Unitarian Universalist joy requires making space for the surprise that Holmes describes. Claiming the possibility of Unitarian Universalist joy requires slowing down to hear the talk of the drum, pausing to move to the rhythms of the drum. Unitarian Universalist joy requires opening to the possibility of the mystical encounter. Unitarian Universalist joy requires embodying this faith differently than many of us are accustomed to.
Last summer at General Assembly, I walked out of the sanctuary we had made from the convention center space. As tired as I was, I returned more and more to my deeply introverted default of self, and I passed a woman who had to stop to talk with me. Many religious professionals who have led a morning worship service know this is where the work begins. She walked up to me and said, "Dr. Rideout." Because she had enough grace to remind me of my title, she gave me the opportunity to resume my church face and posture. She held my hands as if we had known each other for the longest time. She looked into my eyes and she said, "You know what? I always sing that song, there is more love right here. There is more love right here. I'm gonna keep on because I found it. There is more love right here. I don't understand why it is that we don't sing that here at General Assembly. We've already found a community of love." And because she had enough compassion and grace to call me Dr. Rideout, she had given me enough time and opportunity to summon up a bit of stillness from the weary remnants of my churchman's posture. She looked into my eyes and spoke and sang to me with her own truth. She asked with genuine curiosity why it is that we don't all sing the words that she had come to know. I was compelled to respond to the woman I had just met with, "Thank you for trusting me with that question." And then I explained to her why I thought it was necessary, particularly with the music of people of color, that we enter and examine these songs with more curiosity than colonization. I thanked her, and I explained that for those of us who live with the privilege of knowing love, it can be difficult to understand the perspective of one who lives without such a privilege. I explained that it can be difficult to understand the lived experience of those who have trouble finding the evidence of love in their immediate vicinity, in their church, in their neighborhood, in their city, in their nation, even in their planet. I thanked her, and I explained that for some who don't share the privilege of perceiving love right here, moving toward that idea of privilege had become a vital practice of Black faith. I offered that if we, as a spiritual community of Unitarian Universalists, populated by well-meaning people, are to mean anything to the lives and the deaths of people of color, we must begin by learning, not squelching, but learning the forms of expression that arise from these living perspectives. And she said, "Thank you. I'd never heard it expressed that way. I've never understood it that way. And I will never sing it that same way again." When we inhabit the music, the forms of expression of people who live their lives along the margins of notice, we must notice that we have entered holy ground, a sacred space of learning, a sacred space of relationship.